government no longer collected, kept records, or at least published them. Now, the Constitution very clearly puts the president in charge of the military, a fact which found its way into George Bush's brain and exited his mouth in the form of, "I'm the commander guy." But this does not put the president in charge of launching war, or in charge of rules for prisoners of war, or in charge of funding and creating the military, or making rules to govern and regulate the military, because the Constitution gives all of these powers, and most other powers, to Congress, along with the power to raise and support armies for wars. The Constitution bans the appropriation of any money for that purpose for longer than 2 years, which means that during a lengthy war, Congress has to decide at least every 2 years whether to keep fighting it, and therefore the commander guy does not have the power to begin or end wars, but only the power to serve as the commander of the military, determining how a war is fought, while it is fought. This war, any war by the United States is illegal if not declared by Congress or if Congress has declared it over. And this was the clear intention of the authors of the Constitution. Now, unconstitutional wars have become the norm by now, with Democrats having launched at least as many as Republicans. Nonetheless, George Bush managed in this area, as in many, to outdo his predecessors. For one thing, he repeatedly declared in signing statements that Congress cannot in any way regulate the military. Never mind that the Constitution says precisely the opposite. This power is also being stripped away by the increased use of mercenaries not properly regulated by Congress. Now, three proposals have been floated recently that I know of related to the War Powers Act. One of them awful. The other two, I think, commendable. The first, the awful one, comes from a bipartisan commission of elder statesmen including Ed Meese, Warren Christopher, James Baker, Lee Hamilton. The proposal that they put out in July 2008 was, predictably enough, to repeal the War Powers Act and replace it with an act requiring that the president, quote, consult with Congress prior to launching a war. This role of consultant is exactly the role current congressional leaders want, a role once played with more grace by court jesters. But it is a recipe for legislating in place the aggrandizement of the executive that James Madison and others were very, very worried about. The second proposal seeks instead to improve things. And this comes from a local here who I usually disagree with, a guy named Larry Sabato, who in 2007 put out a book called A More Perfect Constitution, where he recommends an amendment to the Constitution that would add to the War Powers Act the requirement that congressional authorizations of war include time limits. And after which Congress has to vote each time it runs out to extend the war. Now, while I agree that time limits would be good, I think, and that a constitutional amendment would be ideal, I think we should start with legislation to do that exact same thing, and I would add that those limits should not be more than 12 months. The third proposal comes from a white paper published by the Center for Constitutional Rights in April of this year, which said, because it is so difficult to end wars once begun, which we have seen as public opinion has gone 180 degrees, but the war keeps going. Because it's so difficult to end them once begun, they propose eliminating the permission that the War Powers Act currently and unconstitutionally grants for a president to wage war for 60 to 90 days without congressional approval, arguing that the only exception should be for short-term use of force to repel, which is not to retaliate for, but to repel sudden attacks on U.S. territories, troops, or citizens. Now, I would strip out the language troops and citizens, which looks to me like an easy way to gin up an excuse for a war. I would leave it with territories. CCR also proposes adding an adequate enforcement mechanism to deal with occasions on which presidents violate the law. A new law would prohibit the use of funds for actions violating the law, allow for judicial oversight in cases of conflict between the Congress and the president, and explicitly make a violation of this law an impeachable offense. And then, of course, when Congress does authorize military action, it still has to be in accordance with the UN Charter and international law. And it must not be treated as the supposed authorization to engage in abuses of power and violations of rights. We also need a reform, I think, that I would call the Cheney-Halliburton Act. And this would make war profiteering by any war maker a major felony. This would apply to employees of the federal government and anyone who within the past decade has been an employee of the federal government, in particular the president and the vice president. And I'm very much in favor of another reform that might truly prevent aggressive wars, that some people may object to, and we'll talk about it. When soldiers are sent into wars, they and their friends and family do not play any significant role in the war-making decisions. Yet their lives are put at risk on the basis of claims made by people themselves taking no risk at all. Claims of a sort that have, through the course of history, proven almost universally false. The United States is not supposed to have a lower class that suffers and dies and an upper class that decides when others should suffer and die. There is a simple way around this. We should require that in any war, the military-aged children and grandchildren of the president, the vice president, all cabinet officials, and all Congress members serve on the front lines in the riskiest positions.
Right.
Oh, how cruel and awful, right? But how much more cruel and awful to send other people's children to those places. War is our biggest business. It is our grandest undertaking. It is the bulk of our public expenditure. Why should our government itself not be involved? An updated United States Constitution, I would suggest, and in the book I propose all sorts of endeavors in each direction that I think we should go, including this one, and many steps short of amending the Constitution, but to have a vision, ideally, out there. An updated U.S. Constitution, I think, in this regard, would say that no more than 25% of discretionary U.S. government spending in any given year can be devoted to military expenses of any sort, including wars, including debt and interest payments for past military expenses and wars, and including care for veterans. Second, all military veterans must be provided with free, comprehensive health care and education. Third, the United States is forbidden to maintain a military presence in a foreign nation, to engage in any war of aggression, to employ mercenaries, or to make use of military force on American soil except when actually engaged in a defensive war against a foreign nation. Fourth, the executive cannot begin a war without authorization and funding from Congress, and Congress cannot provide those for longer than 1 year at a time. Fifth, a congressional vote to end a war is not subject to a presidential veto. Sixth, during war, the children and grandchildren of the president, vice president, all cabinet officers, and every member of Congress who are of military age must serve in the most dangerous combat positions. Sixth, is that six? One, two, three, four, five. Seventh, a president, vice president, or member of Congress who profits financially from any war and is convicted of doing so in a court of law, shall be imprisoned for a minimum of 10 years, and there shall be no statute of limitations on the crime. There's my proposals. some of them. And I want to open this up to questions and answers and discussions, but I also want to pass something around that the good folks from the Center for, from the Charlottesville Center for Peace and Justice and other peace and activist groups. Oh, it's not that group.
Citizens
in Charlottesville who like peace and justice are starting to organize a committee to hold a forum in this town about what's happening in Afghanistan. And if you want to join with us in thinking through what sort of an event we want to have and making it happen, sign up. It's coming around. Yes, sir, and feel free to identify yourself for not...
I'm John Titus. I think requiring the children and grandchildren of the high officials to serve in the most dangerous position is unfair to them. It's not their fault they are in the position they're in, the children and grandchildren of the president and vice president. I think it would be better to have a universal draft. You haven't mentioned that. Why is that?
I don't think it's a bad idea. On your first point, I completely agree. It's absolutely unfair. It's repulsive. But so is the current situation. So unless you've got some serious alternative, I think it's more fair than the other because the result would be that we wouldn't be fighting these wars, and so nobody would be being treated unfair, rather than hundreds of thousands of people whose parents had nothing to do with it being treated unfairly. Should we have a universal draft? Probably. I mean, we should not have the standing military of the size and structure and expense and financial power that we do. It should be the case that if we're going to go fight a war, we have to have a draft. And if we have a draft, it has to be fair and universal. We should also have, and many of these things I do discuss in other chapters of the book, but we should also have the right to be a conscientious objector. And then you would have to have that right for the children of those making the decisions as well. So it's complicated questions. It really is. And to get to a point where you would need a draft, we have to do something about the existing structure of the military, which allows them to maintain an empire around the world without a draft. But I agree. It would be another approach to discouraging unnecessary wars.
Well, David, first of all, I want to congratulate you for this book.
Thank you. Thank you.
It does seem, as you indicated in your last statement, that we are getting more people to volunteer for the military than we need, you know, without the draft. Matter of fact, I saw something the other day saying that 7,000 were rejected because they didn't qualify. So it must have meant that several hundred thousand, you know, did accept. So I don't think that would solve that problem. The other thing, though, is you mentioned a lot on changing the law. During my lifetime, I've seen a lot of laws on the book that have not been executed. And particularly we've seen this, as you've mentioned, in Washington. Now, what kind of a, how are we going to enforce the law if we have a law that says some of the things you're saying? Because the people who are in charge are able to skirt that and to say that they're above the law.
That's the major problem and the single biggest focus of this book, because there's no point in having better laws if we aren't enforcing the laws we've got, and if we're establishing that there are two types of people in this country, that there are the people who have to obey laws or be punished, and the other people who make the laws and do not have to comply with them. And that's what we're looking at with the latest proposal out of the Justice Department to investigate the possibility of having a prosecution against certain low-ranking CIA employees and staffers and contractors for particular incidents of torture, with immunity for the lawyers and the top officials who created the policy. You can understand why Alberto Gonzalez himself, even for a minute, agreed with it and took that back, because the idea is to impose laws. I mean, you have someone like Ed Meese out of the Reagan administration who said when he was in office, you know, if you're accused of a crime, you're guilty, right? I mean, we didn't even need to have courts anymore, right? And if anyone who's accused of a crime is guilty, right? Well, he wants immunity for these people, right? So it's a class division. It's an idea that certain people should be above any sort of law. And the interesting thing about the latest proposal out of the Justice Department is that a lot of the pretense is gone. A lot of the pundits just in the past week have sort of dropped the pretense that they think laws should apply to top officials, including presidents and vice presidents and cabinet secretaries. They just openly think that would be disastrous, that would be traumatic, and so forth. We have to undo that first. We have to make laws apply to everyone first, or there's no point in having laws, particularly laws intended to restrain the abuses of those at the top. I completely agree with you. And the fact that they have this prosecution underway, or this investigation into whether, etc., could be, you know, it's going to be worse than nothing if they do it the way they've designed it, because it's going to establish that a president can tell a lawyer, just write me a memo that says this obvious crime is legal, keep it secret, don't tell anybody, and then it will be legal. We'll establish that. Bush will not have established that. Bush was a freak thing. Obama and Holder will have established that. But if the prosecution is expanded to go after more people, which is likely. It's not going to be hard to make it expand if they really do it, because people are going to squeal on each other. Then it could do a lot of good. And so we can push the Justice Department. We can push Congress to push the Justice Department. We can push the media to push the Justice Department. We can encourage whistleblowers. We can work with the groups filing the lawsuits that have told us 90% of what we know thus far about what our government is doing. And we absolutely have to. I completely agree. Did anybody else have any questions? Yes.
I'm always struck by there's a news story that came out a couple years ago, 3 years ago, thereabouts. It was in regard to the Gulf of Tonkin, and it was revealed based on files that were stored away and that were finally released and so forth that it was made up, that it was invented, that it didn't happen the way it was presented at the time. So, I mean, more than one person lied big time, including the President of the United States. And if you read The Best and the Brightest, I just recently reread parts of that book because McNamara passed away. Chapter after chapter, McNamara, Westmoreland, LBJ, they all lied right down the line, year after year after year. So it's almost like you can pass laws, you can do this, you can do that, but it's when it comes, push comes to shove, maintaining an empire, and you use that term, around the globe, and all these things are at stake, these huge corporate conglomerate interests are at stake, they're going to lie. And who's going to be watching? The average person doesn't have the time or the awareness to watch that.
And yet to try to find something positive in such a gloomy discussion,
right,
we actually were a significant force thus far in preventing an attack on Iran. I mean, Dick Cheney is going on TV now whining and moaning about how he wanted to attack Iran and Bush wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. If we had not been clamoring about the lies that took us into Iraq and identifying those very similar lies that they wanted to use to take us into Iran, they would have taken us into Iran. Just as if we hadn't been pushing back and our allies in Congress hadn't been pushing back, Bush would have gone along with Cheney's demands to pardon people. They don't announce the victories, right? You have to decipher where the victories are. But I don't want to give the impression that there wasn't a Gulf of Tonkin, that Bush was the first war liar. I want to read just another paragraph, if you'll indulge me, from the book. In 1812, taking over Canada was going to be a cakewalk. In 1846, Mexico had supposedly attacked the United States, whereas the opposite was true. Ending slavery was a belated excuse for a civil war already underway, much like spreading democracy to Iraq, and it is entirely possible that slavery would have ended fairly swiftly had the South been allowed to secede in peace. The rest of the Western Hemisphere ended slavery without war, and repealing the Fugitive Slave Law would likely have sped slavery's demise in the U.S. South. In 1898, lies about the Spanish that would have made Fox News proud, including lies about the Maine, a ship that was blown up from within, helped launch a U.S. war to liberate Cuba, but the U.S. occupied Cuba instead of liberating it, then occupied the Philippines for good measure, slaughtering people there by the thousands for years. Uvier, alum like myself, Woodrow Wilson, in 1916, re-elected president on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war," and then set up an early version of the White House Iraq group known as the Committee on Public Information, whose mission it was to make Americans hate Germans. The lies, including misinformation about the content of the Lusitania, another ship that launched 1,000 Faces, and which was in fact carrying weapons, were so effective that they shaped the settlement at the end of the First World War, contributing to the rise of Nazism and the Second World War. The United States entered that Second War following an unprovoked attack by the Japanese. Unless the threats we had sent the Japanese and the devastating economic sanctions we had imposed on them count as a provocation, and ignoring the fact that the U.S. Navy had, 9 days before Pearl Harbor, been given orders to shoot down Japanese planes and blow up Japanese boats it encountered. The lies about the Cold War, the Gulf of Tonkin, the mythical babies taken out of incubators prior to the first Gulf War are still familiar to most Americans, and so on. So it's not the lies that are new. What's new is the blatant arrogance that these were almost open lies, that the corporate media knew they were lies while feeding them to us, that Congress knew, and that people around the world knew, and that Colin Powell went to the United Nations and spelled out lies that anybody with any sort of information in their head knew were blatant, arrogant lies. There was a new level here. The Gulf of Tonkin, you found out some information decades later. Many of these things you found out several decades later. Here we knew as it was happening. So I think there was a difference. But I think that we have to push back, and we're getting smarter and faster and better, and we're building independent media, and we need to bust up the corporate media and create openings for independent and public media. The corrupting forces that I look at in the book and how to fix them, including money, including parties, including power, including the media. Media may be the biggest. It certainly is the most common excuse you get from progressive politicians as to why they will not act. Mm-hmm. The media would attack me. Right? So we have to work on it. But, you know, for the past several years, increasingly, you get more and more information from books. It's part of why I thought it might be a good idea to write a book. I've learned more from books than from newspapers. The first draft of history is now in books because the newspapers are so useless. Was there something?
Yeah. Just following up on that, I just wonder what your take on, I guess the justification for the wars we're in right now is primarily a response to Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden in particular. Why do we hear so little about that?
It's a good question. The question, if I understood it right, was why do we not hear much anymore about Al-Qaeda and 9/11 when that supposedly is the reason we're fighting these wars and this global war on terror and so on.
Well, we do in Afghanistan. They talk about
Afghanistan. They talk about it all the time.
They just call them
Afghanistan.
We also have the purposeful conflation of Al-Qaeda with the Taliban so that we can attack the Taliban as if they had done something. But, you know, what they did was have a place where some people came and stayed and then left. We're not bombing every hotel chain around the world. The fact is that the people who really wanted these wars wanted them long before Bush was in the White House, long before 9/11 happened. The project for the new American century made its goals and its strategies publicly known, knew that they could not be done without a new Pearl Harbor, and seized upon 9/11 as that new Pearl Harbor, and have been abusing that ever since. And, you know, we ought to have treated 9/11 as the horrendous crime it was, and sought to capture and prosecute anyone responsible for it, and still should, which is what the view of any informed statesmen and women around the world was, which is why the United Nations didn't legalize that one either. We went in and attacked Afghanistan, making things worse. And we are still there, still making it worse. The few people that we supposedly went there to find are largely admitted not to be there. Of course, we're bombing Pakistan, too, which Congress was never even asked about. When someone blew up a building in Oklahoma City, the solution was not to bomb Oklahoma. It was not to go bomb Oregon, too, for good measure. And it was not to have a global war against people who look like Oklahomans, right? This would not have been seen as constructive. Right, and in Afghanistan, is the third poorest country on the planet. People are starving. The Taliban is made up of people who are starving, who are being paid enough to eat to fight for the Taliban. Is the proper solution to that problem to bomb their families? How will that give them employment? How will that give them food? How will that give them any of the things they need? I think we need a very different approach, but I think that it's a good question because it reveals the fact that the lines you're fed when they're launching a war have very little to do with the actual motivations for the war, which sometimes become clear to a lot of people once the war turns into a permanent, ongoing occupation and expanded for no apparent reasons, and no one, you know, after eight, we're going to be at 8 years in Afghanistan very soon, beginning of next month, and no one can even define what a victory would mean, what the goal might be for the next 8 years.
On that point, have you covered the War Powers Act at all? Here today, I came in late.
Yeah.
Primarily, I talked about the War Powers Act, but if you have a question in fact, I mentioned that I had met you and therefore spoke about the War Powers Act.
Oh, okay. So, well, this is very pertinent to his question, because the current authorization conveying war powers to the president is obviously blatantly unconstitutional. It says it conveys to the president the power to use military force against persons and organizations that he determines. And there's no way that can possibly be justified under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And so then that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. And then if you trace it back through the evolutions of our efforts to try to clean up our wars since World War II and to come to some kind of a creative way so that we can have wars and not violate the Constitution, there's a long history of bungled legislation that we call war powers. As a matter of fact, there's no law other than the Constitution that conveys war powers to the president that defines the word war or uses it. It's all military force, and there's a reason for that. The word war is used in the Constitution. They're just trying to get around it. And so this is what we inherit. We inherit, this is a war on terror, may I ask? Who surrenders? Who signs the treaty?
Right.
War is the use of military force against a sovereign nation to compel capitulation and an enforceable treaty. If you don't have someone to sign a treaty, and if the treaty so signed is not enforceable, you don't have a war. You're fighting a police action. Under a police action, is it justifiable to kill civilians? Do the police kill civilians? Yeah, they do, and we raise hell when they do it, but rarely. So you have a military organization doing a police function, which they now admit is a police function. They're going to win the hearts and minds. They're going to patrol the block. The military cannot do that.
Yeah, very well said. And
the reason that all these bystanders are getting killed is because it's not the military's fault. It's what they do. But they're not police.
Excuse me.
And the problem is no one is
permitted. It is the military's fault.
But they do it. Yeah.
Well, it's the military's fault
it's because
accepting that.
It was the military's fault because we've allowed the United States Air Force and the United States Army to dominate our war-making efforts. And they apply, they're obviously incompetent, and they apply methods that they apply, the only tools they have, which don't fit the, which don't fit the, situation on the ground, and haven't for frankly a couple hundred years.
I stand corrected. You're right.
May I offer something?
Please go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say to this gentleman first that I had hoped you were going to be here because I wanted to get your opinion on what I had to say about the War Powers Act. And so, if you would,
books and hand them out, and I need one signed, and so I'm hanging.
Okay, if you'll do me the favor of reading what I said and giving me some feedback, I'd really. It's quite all right. Why don't we take one or two more questions and then talk? Yes. Yes. Go ahead.
I just want to offer a couple of things that I've been reading a lot of military history. Actually, to be forthcoming, I was raised in the United States Marine Corps by a Marine Corps officer. And there's a number of notions that there's been talk among certain circles and some of the prominent the writers critical of the administration and the military, former military men, have come up with a number of suggestions. And I thought it'd be interesting to toss them in. And I think important for as an approach to this thing, one is to actually abolish the United States Air Force, which we spent the majority of the budget. The second one would actually be to abolish the service academies as they are and make the first requirement for an officer's commission to be a 4-year liberal arts degree. And a third one I would think of would be to make it against the law for United States citizens to serve as mercenaries or contractors.
Absolutely.
And I want to, I mentioned, you said, they may sound absurd, but people, such individuals as Andrew Besovich, who were decorated, and all the recent work. These are people, these are very thoughtful, intelligent people, and I would go on, but let me just...
I think thinking in those directions is exactly what's needed, and there are a lot of proposals along those lines and other similar ones that I discuss in the book, pro and con, and some I come down in favor of and some I don't. I think there are a lot of parts of the military that should be eliminated and restrictions that should be put on the military, and I think that our nuclear arsenal should be eliminated, and I think our program for weapons in space should be eliminated, and I think our empire of 1,000 bases around the globe should be eliminated. I think perhaps the National Security Advisor should be eliminated. I the 2 points that I have to sort of think about a little more before I say yes right away are the four-year liberal arts. I'm not sure that wouldn't damage four-year liberal arts programs as much as it improved. But and the
damage has already been done.
Yes. Well, let's try to undo and improve it. And the other is the. Is that United States citizens cannot serve as mercenaries. Certainly, I don't think United States citizens should serve as mercenaries, but a lot of our mercenaries are not United States citizens. I think serving as a mercenary should not be possible under the United States government by anyone of any citizenship, much less, as with our military, being a path to United States citizenship. I was going to take one more question, if there was one, or if not...
What always bothers me is, compared to the system in England, I always forget, have we ever impeached a president?
We have impeached two presidents, but not convicted any presidents.
Okay, but we kicked out of office.
No. To impeach does not mean to kick out of office. We have impeached a lot of people, actually. Most of them judges, a senator, a Secretary of War, as we used to more honestly call it, but we have only impeached two presidents. But to impeach is to charge, is to indict. Okay. And you have a trial in the Senate. In both cases, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, they were acquitted in the Senate.
Well, I'm talking about removal from office. We've never done that, then.
Well, Richard Nixon knew that he was about to be impeached and convicted, so he resigned and left.
Right, but we've made it so difficult. Compared to the system in England, where they vote in Parliament, or where there's a vote, and then 6 weeks later they hold a new election, we have such an imperial presidency, a king-like president. We've decided that it's just so traumatic to remove a president from office, we can't do it.
Well, we haven't. Polls during the Bush reign showed a majority wanting him impeached. But, well, our Democratic Party... Republicans love impeachment, and will impeach anybody they can, and Democrats are willing to impeach Democrats, and they're willing to impeach for sex. I mean, a couple months ago, the House Judiciary Committee impeached a judge in Texas for groping employees, right? We have governors across the nation being impeached for sex in New York, and maybe in South Carolina now, we have a governor in...
Well, I'm just saying, we've made it so difficult, so almost near impossible to remove a president from office. The only thing they face is re-election every four years, second term. Otherwise, they're in. That's it.
True. Because of a lot of different forces of corruption that we can talk about.
But if it was easy, I mean, in my opinion, just kick the bomb out, and then you get the vice president. But it should just be something that could happen matter-of-factly, instead of this huge, it goes on for months and hearings and this, it's so traumatic. So what? We elected him, he's supposed to do a job, he doesn't do a job, kick him out. Big deal.
But I would correct a little bit the myths about how traumatic and long enduring and so forth, because impeachments and convictions on average have taken a couple weeks. We've impeached someone and convicted him the next day. We've impeached people
presidents?
Within 3 days of the offense they committed.
Andrew Johnson.
Well, that was before impeachment. The impeachment process that was short-circuited did not go on and on and on. It was a matter of weeks, and even Clinton was a matter of a few months. So it shouldn't be too easy. And the president should not be such a big deal. The president should not have the sort of powers to decide the fate of the world that it matters so much whether he is in office or not. But certainly, when a president does anything remotely approaching a fraction of what President Cheney did, we should be able to impeach. Yes, President Cheney. This is who was president. We should be able to impeach, and that requires changing the forces that determine what people like Nancy Pelosi think is advantageous to them, and that can be done. Maybe we should talk a little more informally, and I'll be happy to sign any books. And thank you all very much for coming, and sign the Afghanistan thing and give it to Sarah, who's thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
And me. Thank you. And thank you to Barnes & Noble.
Okay.